Production support for Earth Eats comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. And The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. Welcome to Earth Eats. I'm Kate Young.
He will take a tortilla and he will serve Persian food or Armenian food, or we had turmeric with chicken the other day with him. He says, is it authentic Mexican food? Absolutely not, but it's authentic to me.
On today's show, we talk about taco trucks and street vendors from Los Angeles, California to Bloomington, Indiana. We visit with Dr. Sarah Portnoy of the University of Southern California about her book on Latino food culture in LA. And we talk with Pilar Gonzalez of Pili's Party Tacos, a food truck right here on the streets of Bloomington. And just in time for snap pea season, Chef Daniel Orr shares a beautiful salad recipe featuring garden fresh sugar snaps and thinly sliced fennel. So stay with us. Alex Chambers is back with the news this week. What's going on?
Well, what's going on is structural racism in the land-grant university system and a major merger in industrial agriculture.
That doesn't sound good.
Well, it is the news. But it's about addressing racism, so that's something.
All right, let's hear it.
Land-grant universities are being called upon to address structural racism. In May 2017, the Association of Public and Land-Grant Universities released a report on how public universities should contribute to global food security. But a group of experts who helped write the report noticed a glaring gap in the report's details: systemic racism in the country's land-grant universities. The group, called the Interinstitutional Network for Food, Agriculture, and Sustainability, responded with an essay in February that outlines institutional racism in land-grant universities. The essay describes how Jim Crow segregation played out in higher education. In 1890, a separate system of land-grant colleges was created for African Americans who'd been denied access to white colleges for decades. The essay goes on to describe the ways people of color have been denied access to land for generations and says that's part of why there are higher rates of food insecurity for people of color today. Agricultural research programs perpetuate racial inequality by keeping grants and knowledge confined to agricultural schools, even in cases where the research is intended to help minority or rural communities. This idea was underscored recently in a statement from Atlanta Congressman David Scott, who called the 2018 Farm Bill racist. The bill stripped a provision that would have provided $95 million in minority scholarships for students at the 1890 land-grant African-American schools to study agriculture and food sciences. The congressman said the 1890 colleges have never gotten the financial support the white colleges had. It's time, he said, for these schools to finally be treated with the respect and dignity they deserve. German pharmaceutical giant Bayer is one step closer in its two-year quest to purchase the U.S. industrial agriculture company, Monsanto. The $66 billion sale faced some major hurdles, namely an antitrust investigation by the U.S. Department of Justice. After a year-and-a-half-long inquiry, the DOJ announced on Tuesday that the merger could move forward. The sale will create the largest agrochemical and seed company in the world. Already, the two companies control nearly 60% of U.S. cottonseed, and Monsanto alone controls over 80% of the corn and 90% of the soybeans grown in the U.S. Together, they could supply up to 29% of the world's seeds and 24% of the world's pesticides. Bayer-Monsanto isn't the first agrochemical merger in recent years. In 2015, Dow and DuPont merged, just months before Syngenta was taken over by ChemChina. The approval of Monsanto's acquisition by Bayer leaves just four companies in control of the majority of the world's agrochemical research and sales. Farm advocates are concerned about the consequences for farmers of continued corporate consolidation. National Farmers Union President Roger Johnson said consolidation drives up costs for farmers and limits their choice of products in the marketplace. Another important facet of the merger is the controversial Monsanto brand. Monsanto has faced controversy for years over its genetically modified seeds, as well as its glyphosate-based weed killer, Roundup. Those and other issues made Monsanto the third most hated company in the world, according to a 2014 poll. If the Monsanto brand ceases to exist, their controversial reputation could disappear while their products remain. Bayer estimates it will take about 2 months to conclude the deal. The company is also waiting on approval of the sale from the Canadian and Mexican governments. Thanks to Chad Bouchard and Taylor Killow for those stories.
And thanks to you, Alex Chambers, for bringing them.
My pleasure, Kate.
My sugar snap peas are in full production in the garden this week, so I am excited to hear about this simple dish featuring fresh peas with a delicate balance of flavors. If you don't have your own harvest of snap peas, I bet you can find some this week at your local farmer's market.
Today we're going to do a salad, and I'm going to use some of our late winter spring vegetables like fennel. It's got a kind of an anisey, licorice-y flavor, so we're going to take some of that, and I've just peeled off the outside parts and then sliced it thinly. I'm going to add some sugar snap peas. So these are kind of the spring part of this dish. So when you're cooking between seasons, it's nice to kind of mix the two seasons together. So, you know, a fall vegetable, a winter vegetable, and then some nice spring vegetables. So these are sugar snap peas. And I think sugar snap peas are for people that, you know, kids that don't like vegetables. This is the first vegetable I think you can really get them to like, because it's almost like candy, you know, so it's kind of a gateway vegetable. And hopefully they'll get hooked on vegetables after that. And then one more fun ingredient, we're gonna add some blueberries. The blueberries, again, are gonna play off that sweetness of the fennel and the sugar snap peas. And to that, I'm going to make the vinaigrette right on top of the salad. I'm going to add a tablespoon of local Hoosier honey, juice of one lemon, juice of a lime, and juice of half an orange. And I love orange and pea pods. It's a great flavor if you want to serve your pea pods hot. Reduce a little bit of orange juice way down and then toss the pea pods in that reduced orange juice. It's delicious. Now with these pea pods, what I did was I blanched and shocked them. And we've talked about that before on Earth Eats. Blanching is where you cook them in highly salted boiling water just until their color's set. And then shocking is where you drop them into ice water. And that stops the cooking, keeps the color, and it's really a nice way to prep vegetables. In restaurants, you do that a lot. Par cook everything so you can send it out really quickly. Now I'm finishing with some salt and pepper, say about a half teaspoon of salt and about the same of pepper. Toss that, and then we're gonna add some extra virgin olive oil. Okay, about a quarter cup of extra virgin olive oil. And this is a time where you use your good olive oil, that expensive olive oil, should be used for finishing dishes and in light vinaigrettes that don't have a whole lot of acid in them. I'm gonna taste this. So light and fresh and summery. This would be a great dish to serve with some grilled chicken mixed in to make it a main course, or even some diced firm tofu if you're vegetarian. But it would also find a really nice place at a table alongside some grilled pork chops or grilled salmon. So you can make this ahead, just add the vinaigrette at the last minute, A lot of times during the summertime, I'll make salads like this, where I make the vinaigrette right on top of the salad, and I'll wait to toss it until just before I serve it. So you have everything in there. When your guests come over, all you gotta do is toss it together. But you don't wanna toss it ahead of time because the acidity and the salt will make the vegetables limp. So you can make your vinaigrette right over your salad, leave it, and then just toss it all together right before you hit the table. I'm gonna just drizzle some of this on top. You can see it's a very light vinaigrette. There's not a lot of oil in it, super fresh. And if you have them, use them. I got some edible flowers here, got some chives. I've got some flowers from the black locust. And that's how you throw a party.
This recipe will be on our website, along with a full archive of recipes for spring or any season of the year. That's eartheats.org.
My sweet pea, you're the one to get my heart a-jumping. Light of love all around, you'll be in to see.
Production support comes from Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeigner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Need more coffee roasters? A woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. Offering signature drinks, teas, and little eats. Located on Pete Ellis Drive, needmoreroasters.com. And Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. As the weather warms up in Indiana, it's time for outdoor dining. Cafes open up their patio seating. We've got prepared food vendors at the farmers market, food truck Fridays, and street food downtown in the evenings. In Los Angeles, the climate allows for year-round street food, but that doesn't mean that there are no barriers for food trucks and push carts. A recent guest in our studio knows a lot about street vendors in LA. Professor Sarah Portnoy is the author of Food, Health, and Culture in Latino Los Angeles, and she teaches courses in Latino food culture and Latino food justice in the Spanish language department at the University of Southern California in LA. Maddie Chera of the IU Food Institute interviewed her in April when she came to IU to give a talk. Students in Dr. Portnoy's classes look at the lack of access to healthy, affordable, culturally appropriate foods in low-income Latino neighborhoods. They study the role that food trucks and street vendors play in Latino food culture. And Portnoy takes students out to sample dishes from food trucks and to talk with the vendors. One topic that comes up in Portnoy's own work and in her classes is authenticity. Maddie Chera wanted to hear more about that.
So do you find that the different people in the community that you and your students work with have different ideas about authenticity and appropriation when it comes to food?
For sure. For example, we just went to the food truck of a really well-known chef. He's got a truck called Guerrilla Tacos, and he's about to open a brick-and-mortar restaurant. And he will take a wonderful corn tortilla, but he will take a tortilla and he will serve Persian food or Armenian food, or he wouldn't call it that kind of food, but those flavors, those spices on it. You know, we had turmeric with chicken the other day with him, and we're trying to guess, what is this? And he says, is it authentic Mexican food? Absolutely not, but it's authentic to me. That really was interesting or provocative for the students.
But not everyone holds such a relaxed view of what counts as authentic Mexican cuisine.
In fact, the first speaker I ever bring in for the semester, his name is Bill Esparza, and he wrote this book, El Mexicano, and he was really to bring out a lot of the food truck owners, to give them a place on the culinary landscape, the culinary map of Los Angeles. He's gone down to Tijuana and Baja and brought those chefs, taqueros, to Los Angeles. He curated this enormous taco festival that we had for many years. So he's put a lot of people on the map who would definitely have been in the margins otherwise. So I always bring him as the first speaker. And he has this very traditional view of what can be Mexican food and what is not, and that it's got to be, the more hyper-regional it is, the better. You know, anything that smacks of a combo plate, that's not Mexican food. And when I listen to him, I won't agree with him. And then I always bring in, or I try to bring in, Gustavo Arellano, who wrote the Taco USA book, who has this very breakdown borders, anything is acceptable. Anything that's made by a Mexican is Mexican food. Taco Bell, it might be crap, but it's Mexican food. And so I feel like I fit, after a certain point of listening to them both for many years, somewhere in between. So it's really interesting for my students because they get to hear these two polar opposite views throughout the semester, and we discuss the different perspectives on authenticity and how you define national cuisine or even regional cuisine and so on, and borders and borrowing and all of those topics that go along with the discussion of food studies.
What it comes down to is this. Defining regional authenticity is complicated.
Can you define one American cuisine? What is American cuisine? Well, there's a certain kind of food you'll find in the South. New England has another food. California, we're all about everything being healthy and fresh and vegetables. If you go to New Orleans, you're going to get Cajun cuisine. So you can't really define one American cuisine in the same way you cannot define a Mexican cuisine. There, every region has its own specialties, its own cuisine, and you know there's great variation, particularly from northern to southern Mexico. In northern Mexico, they eat flour tortillas. You're not going to find that in the south. They eat a lot more beef in the north. Oaxaca is known as the land of the seven moles, but they have a million different kind of moles, which are these sauces that some of them use chocolate, nuts, a variety of spices, chiles, and so on. And every area will have their own mole that they're known for. You can't define one Mexican cuisine. Interestingly, what triggered my quest to work on this area of Latino food studies in LA is I was listening to our local NPR show on food. It's called Good Food. And every week they have a discussion between Evan Kleinman, who's the host, and Jonathan Gold, who's our Pulitzer Prize-winning food journalist. And somebody called in and asked Jonathan if he would consider Tito's Tacos to be authentic Mexican food. So what is Tito's Tacos? It's one of those old-school Mexican-American places that sells the hard-shell taco with ground beef, cheddar cheese, the shredded lettuce, your dollop of sour cream, all of that stuff that I would say is not Mexican food, right? So somebody asked him that. I pulled over the car so I could listen closely. And he said, yeah, it's Mexican food because Southern California is a region of Mexico unto itself. Hey, it was part of Spain. Then it was part of Mexico, right? The border crossed it. It was part of Mexico before it became part of the United States in 1850. So it's got a long history of Mexican cuisine, primarily originally from northern Mexico. But we also have the second largest population of Mexicans anywhere outside of Mexico City, reportedly. So, of course, we have our own variations and dishes that are unique to Southern California.
One of the big issues that Dr. Portnoy has been keeping up with is the regulation and rights of the food street vendors in Los Angeles.
So the street vendors have been illegal since 1980. They were banned in Los Angeles. Los Angeles is the only major city of the 10 biggest cities in the U.S. where street vending is illegal. And yet we have over 50,000 street vendors in the city, 10 to 12,000 of whom sell food. They live in the state of fear and anxiety that they're going to have to run at any minute, that the police are going to ticket them, that they're going to lose their merchandise, and so on. But yet they're everywhere. They're not just in low-income Latino neighborhoods. They're in middle-class neighborhoods. They're close to upper-middle-class neighborhoods. The neighborhood where I live is really close to where a lot of the Oaxacans live. Oaxaca is a region of southern Mexico that is one of the poorest, and it's primarily indigenous. And it's said that we have somewhere between 80 and 200,000 Oaxacans that live in Los Angeles or Southern California. It's hard to know for sure because most of them are undocumented. And so as a result, there's plenty of street food just right around me. You find people who set up these carts selling tacos al pastor, which is the pork on the spit that rotates, and they get the meat gets sliced thinly, served with a pineapple, slice of pineapple on a tortilla. That's taco al pastor for $1, $1.50. That's street food right in my neighborhood. Fruit carts. They're fruit carts that dot the landscape of the city all around the place. Anywhere you see an umbrella-colored, a rainbow-colored umbrella, that's a street vendor selling sliced fruit. Very traditional Mexican. You get a traste, you get a container filled with chile and, or, you know, sprinkled chile and lime onto your sliced fruit, and that's as good as it gets for a big bag for, let's say, $4. They have been illegal for a long time. They've been around since LA ever existed, but they've really been fighting hard for legalization over the past few years. And an ordinance was submitted to City Council. City Council voted at the very beginning of February 2017 to decriminalize street vending in the city of Los Angeles. So it was no longer a criminal act, but it was also still not technically legal because they hadn't figured out the terms of the ordinance that they want to pass to make it legal. So that's the legal limbo that we're still in 15 months later.
You can read more about LA's taco truck wars in Sarah Portnoy's book, Food, Health, and Culture in Latino Los Angeles.
Thanks for being here with us today.
Thank you for having me.
We'll have links to her work on our website, eartheats.org. Here in Bloomington, food truck culture has really taken off over the past few years. The city of Bloomington first established food truck guidelines in 2015. One World Enterprises opened a new facility to house their kitchen share program in 2016. The combination of those two events really opened the doors to those ready to try their hand at making and selling food on the street. The kitchen share offers new small-scale food businesses like food trucks the chance to get started without making a huge investment in commercial kitchen space. They rent the space they need by the hour, and One World is completely equipped to support the specific needs of food truck businesses, including parking spaces with electrical service and approved water facilities for food trucks. Pilar Gonzalez took advantage of these services when she decided to open a food truck. For her, a couple of other factors played into the decision. One, she'd been staying home caring for her daughters since they were babies, and she was ready to try something new.
So I want to go back work, and my husband don't want it. So I say, okay, take choice. I go to work or we need to do some business because I don't like to stay in home all day. I don't want my kids seeing me in home all day. They girls and they need to be strong, and I had ideas what she need to do.
The other motivation was culinary. They were craving the tacos they loved, the flavors they remembered from Puebla, where they're from in southern Mexico, and even from the taco stands in New York, where Pilar's husband lived for many years. They weren't finding these kinds of tacos in Bloomington.
When he moved here, say, what is the tacos? I say, I'm sorry, here is no tacos. no any tacos on the night. Okay, I miss the tacos.
To be clear, they were finding tacos in town, just not the kind of tacos they were looking for.
Because we want more authentic, and he say, no, it's not really tacos. We need more authentic tacos. I say, yes. The first they put cheese and lettuce, tomato, and it's not like that. We eat tacos like cilantro, onions, and lime, cucumber, and your salsa.
So they got the idea to open their own taco truck. That would be their business. And they would make their tacos Puebla style with cilantro, cucumber, and lime, and many choices of meats.
We don't buy any meat prep. We buy the meat, raw meat, like big blocks of meat. We clean it, we slice it, we marinate, and we make portions. Longaniza, asada, pastor, arabe, tripa, lengua. Ah, too many.
Tacos aren't the only thing you'll find on the truck. They also serve chalupas, tostados, tortas, and a quesadilla cut like a pizza, playfully called the Gringa. The food truck lifestyle hasn't exactly been easy on Pilar and her family. Everyone's involved, and they share some time together working. Her daughters get to help out sometimes on Saturdays. But it also means a lot of late nights for Pilar.
In the morning, Wednesday, start open 11 o'clock to 3 o'clock in the morning. And Friday and Saturday, we stay in the street almost 4 o'clock in the morning, 4:30. Because later, when close the window, we start to clean everything in the car. Because next day, we open early. And also, Saturday, I know we don't open Sunday. But I had time, I want time with my family. So we need to clean.
While she says she's happy about running the food truck, she talked about what's hardest for her.
Balance family and job, family and work. Yeah. Sometimes my husband saying, when you on the truck, you forget everything. And yes, sometimes I do, because I love this. Yeah. But sometimes when I out the car, start thinking about the family. Oh my God, they need me. Mm-hmm. The balance.
One of the things Pilar likes most about this work is the relationship she's built with customers.
We had a lot of customers coming. They come in and talk to me and talk to the guys and like more friendly. I like to be like that because sometimes they feel more comfort. And sometimes they say, Pilar, give me whatever you want. I'm so hungry. I say, are you sure? I know you choose good. I say, okay, make something, make this, make that. And later they come in, oh, really good, Pilar, thank you. Thank you, no, thank you guys for coming.
You know you have a good relationship with your customers when they trust you to choose the food they're going to eat. Thanks to Alex Chambers for talking with Pilar about her taco truck, Pili's Party Tacos, which can usually be found outside of the Bishop Bar on Walnut and 4th Street in Bloomington. You'll see them at the Farmer's Market on Saturdays and Food Truck Fridays on, well, Fridays. Find their full schedule on our website, eartheats.org. Production support comes from The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom, step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And need more coffee roasters? A woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. Offering signature drinks, teas, and little eats. Located on Pete Ellis Drive. Needmoreroasters.com. That's it for our show this week. Big thanks to the Earth Eats crew, including Ayabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Alex Chambers, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killo, Daniel Orr, and all the folks at Farm Bloomington Restaurant, the IU Food Institute, and Harvest Public Media. Special thanks this week to Maddie Chera, Kane Ferguson, Sarah Portnoy, and Pilar Gonzalez and her family. Earth Eats theme music is composed by Aaron Toby and performed by Aaron and Matt Toby. Our executive producer is John Bailey. I'm Kate Young, and I produce the show. Thanks for listening to Earth Eats, and we'll see you next week.